Okay, so I think we are getting started. Just 5 past. Okay, so hi everyone, I'm Matt Benton. I'm a teaching assistant on this course. So I'm a postdoc in the lab of Siegfried Roth now, but most of what I'll be talking about is work I did during my PhD in the lab of Michael Aiken. But at that time I was working heavily with Tassos Pavlopoulos, who was here for the first 3 weeks. He is who actually invited me here to be his teaching assistant. Unfortunately, I couldn't overlap with him due to a few other things, but I have been pretty happy thus far. I want to say thanks to the organizers for allowing Tassos to bring me as a teaching assistant, because I'm having an awesome time here. This is a really fantastic course. Only problem I've had is the worst sunburn in the last few years. Okay, so I am. This talk is going to be basically entirely qualitative stuff, so you can sort of turn off your brains and have a little daydream. Because I'm heavily interested in evolution, and I'm trying to tie together these fields of evolution and morphogenesis, and then throw in some gene patterning as well, because that is how we can really look at evolution, is through the genes involved in this. So our idea in EvoDevo, this field that I am unfortunately a part of, is to look to basically developmental genetics in different animals. So if these are different animals across the phylogenetic tree, we are generally interested in looking at how the gene regulatory networks, or the axis patterning networks, give rise to the embryo, and then this eventually will give rise to the adult form. And we know the adult form is the part which is most acted on by evolution through natural selection. This is what's exposed to the environment. But there are other mechanisms of evolution which can occur already in the early embryonic stage. So we want to understand the major differences, how we got this diversity of life going all the way from these comb jellies, which have been, when I first made this slide with comb jellies, no one had heard of what these things were. Now they're very sexy with these recent publications on them. Through to what we want to think of the most is what we are, the humans. And these crazy humans here are some of my best friends from my PhD. Unfortunately, these are not very tractable organisms. They misbehave all the time. And so what I have, my sort of compromise, is to end up working on the arthropods. And the arthropods have been evolving as a group, they have been around for an incredibly long time. We think around 550 or 600 million years was the base of the arthropods. And they're a very diverse group. So here we have what is the most basal lineage, the chelicerates. These are spiders and scorpions and terrible little things like that. And then when we have within the insects, we also have incredible diversity, including the most numbers of species out of any group. So it's the most speciose or speciose clade. I always get the two mixed up. Now in my field, we are predominantly looking, especially in the insect EvoDevo, predominantly looking at this little stage here, giving rise to the first embryonic form. And generally when you're reading the books, you see a lot of gene arrow gene diagrams, and then you see people say, and this is how we have the embryo coming out. And they draw just a general arrow, or they might say some stuff happens in here. But of course, this stuff, and I'm generalizing, of course, hugely generalizing. So the stuff involved is morphogenesis, and this itself is a super exciting field in its own right, and that has been the focus of most of this meeting. But what I am trying to get in, and myself and many others now, is the whole lineage of how you get the gene regulatory networks, how they're behaving, and how they're interacting with each other, the different genes, how this drives morphogenesis that eventually gives rise to the embryonic form, and then to try and do this in a comparative framework so we can look at not only how the gene regulatory networks are changing, but how these changes give rise to changes in embryonic form, which is the evolution of the animal from that point of view, which I will tell a little bit about today, and it's how difficult it has been. So the plan is basically, most of it will be about this. I've thrown together quite a few new slides within the past 12 hours. I was going to reuse a talk that I have given previously just a couple of months ago, but then after seeing the themes and the style of talks and the style of questions that have been coming up, I decided to put in a bit more background here and there. This will be a lot of basis about Tribolium itself and this process of embryo formation. If we have time, the last little bit will be my most recent work during my postdoc about how toll genes are involved in axis elongation. So part one, what is this beastie Tribolium? So it's this cute little guy here who gave up its life because it kept moving around when I was trying to take its picture. So it is a beetle. It is very small. This is an ordinary petri dish. So the beetles are about the same size as Drosophila, and this is just sitting on flour, just plain flour that you will have in your kitchen. And it is known as a flour beetle, and it's a huge pest. I mean, some of you may have found it in your kitchens. It's the red flour beetle. Over time, it will turn your flour red. It is actually an excellent source of vitamin B3, so if you do find it in your flour, do not be too worried. You just have that vitamin. But in America, everything is supplemented anyway into your food, so it's fine. So it lives its whole time in flour. It has about a one-month generation time. We culture them at 30 or 32 degrees, but 25 also works. It's very easy to maintain. You can flip them every 6 months, or in one case, as I found the other day, a box from 12 months ago that I hadn't touched, and the population is still happy and going. And that was a transgenic line as well. RNAi for knocking down genes works incredibly well. We can do it at any stage, so you can inject the pupae or the adults and have the full knockdown in the embryos for up to a month afterwards. Or you can do it in the embryos and see the effect immediately, or in different larval stages and look at larval effects. And then transgenics are also available, but we don't have many enhancers, and this has been a big problem over the last few years. The UAS-Gal4 system was published, but since then people have had a lot of difficulty applying it to real-world situations. And finally, we have CRISPR and Cas9 working. There's one publication out on this, and I was recently at a conference, and everyone I talked to was doing it for, specifically we're trying to knock things in. RNAi works so well for knocking down genes that now we want to knock in to endogenous loci, so we don't have to worry about the enhancer problem anymore.
So what's the state of the genome?
The genome is hit or miss. We're now up to the fifth assembly, and it is generally good. But there are when you start working actually with gene structure or the intergenic regions, you run into some problems here and there. So, yeah. But it's improving. There's a real effort to drive this forwards. And now I think four other closely related Tribolium species are being sequenced, and they're doing comparative analyses with those. So starting to take it back to a similarity to Drosophila or other insects, now if we just say across the insects, what are the commonalities? So we've already had this big picture from Cassandra looking at Gryllus, which is very far away from Drosophila. And there are some general plans we can say about the insect eggs. So they're generally, so when they're laid, say this is an egg, it's filled with yolk. You have some nuclei in the center, so the nuclei are located right in the center of the yolk. They then undergo several rounds of division as they spread along, sometimes in a scattered manner, sometimes forming this nice shell that you see in Drosophila. And then as they continue to divide synchronously, they then reach the surface. These are just at the surface, and you can see that they have just divided. And then at the surface, we have this uniform blastoderm stages where there are waves of division, and they are beginning to be separated by membranes, but they're still in a syncytium or a semi-syncytial environment. And what you can see here, this is the waves that you also see in Drosophila are much more pronounced in Tribolium. Now, the egg is a little bit larger, but I think it has something to do with how the membranes are coming down between the nuclei. So finally, you end up with this uniform blastoderm stage. And this is now with a membrane marker. You can see that they are cellularized and they're separated from each other. This is about 9 hours after egg lay. So the difference in the rate of development from Drosophila is huge. And if you want to be studying any of these early stages, it can be a lot easier in Tribolium if you don't care about it actually being a little bit different to Drosophila and having almost none of the same tools as in Drosophila. So then I want to tell you a little bit about how cellularization occurs. So I looked into this during my PhD and collaborated with a friend of mine to look at this in a bit more detail. So This, I just, as I was saying, putting these slides together last minute, I did the lazy thing of just taking a figure out of my thesis. This was also published in Van der Zee et al. In development last year. So at the first stage, if we're looking across the tissue, this is a single section on the confocal, marked for membrane and for nuclei. And you begin to see membranes grow between the nuclei until this here, you can see the membranes are all the way down between the nuclei. So what we have here is, as soon as the nuclei reach the surface, so as I've got in the schematic, membranes begin to grow down between them. And during a division, shown here, so this is a cell which is, or a protocell which is dividing, new membrane goes in between them. At no time do you have membrane retractions, as you do, as you see in other long germ systems like in Drosophila. The next phase is basal closure. And basal closure happens across here. The time points will come up shortly. So this is, these are now closed basally, and you can see they're cuboidal cells. So they're not columnar cells. And it turns out, so across the insects, your embryo wants to make columnar cells. That'll come back up soon. But it seems only the dipterans have found a way of immediately making columnar cells before they close their bases off. And the others have come up with, there are consequences for making your cells columnar when you are initially cuboidal. So we can look at the same process. This is now a cross-section along the base of the cells, of these same cells, and you can see these rings closing.
Okay, can you remind us what's the difference between cuboidal?
So it's just as it sounds. So cuboidal have this, they are not elongated in the apical basal axis of the cell, so they're more like cubes, and then columnar cells are long and to the
lattice is hexagonal or square?
So this is what we can see up here. So initially it's very disorganized, and then in the end it becomes much more refined. So this is an increase in, I took this as an increase in cortical tension. And we also, we have some ideas of that junctions between cells are beginning to form around these stages. Yeah.
So you see in D prime, you see that the stalks are beginning to cluster. Is this before the beginning of gastrulation or after? Has any movement of this tissue started?
No tissue movement, all blastoderm stage. And so what these like little random enrichments of, or I said random, these little patchy enrichments of GAP43, you mean?
Yeah, I assume that it's just, I mean, at least in Drosophila, you see those structures where the stalks, the basal sides of the cells are sort of clustered with one another. Is that sort of what you think?
We don't see this, any clustering like that. Okay. This is same as this guy, same as this guy. So you can see the membranes are vertical. So there's no basal clustering of stalks.
Sorry, what is the last row? What are we seeing?
This?
Yeah.
So this is a section through the base of the cells, through here. And this is the membrane marker GAP43 YFE. Turns out it works really well in Tribolium as well. But, I mean, it's from zebrafish, so it should work in many things.
Based on the slide before, it seems that the cellularization process is not synchronous between cells. You have a region where it forms, other region will form later.
No, so that's, I checked as much as I could around, and this is not a really, I mean, looking at this sort of level is not a, you are somewhat arbitrary and when you say cellularization is complete, but it does seem to be uniform, as much as I could tell without simultaneously looking at different parts. Yeah, we had this question as well. There's a report in some basal flies that the extraembryonic tissue cellularizes later, but I saw no evidence of this through lineage tracing. So the paper is published here in Morai and Van der Zee et al. And as the title suggests, we actually found this protein, Annexin-7A, has a novel function in this process of cellularization. And there are junctions at the base of the cell, which have not been described in Drosophila, may not exist in Drosophila, that we saw through TEM. And we think Annexin is involved in this, that we were knocking this down, and this is exactly where the defects were. So check it out if you are interested. So now moving on to the stage of actual embryo condensation itself. So we're sitting, we have a uniform blastoderm, and now we're going to make our embryo from this. And this is when the topic of germs comes up. And we have, across the insects, we have two extremes in how you make your germ band or how your embryo is patterned. We have the long germ form, which is what we know so well from Drosophila and a few other insects as well, where you have, if this is a blastoderm, your entire AP axis will be embryo. This is embryonic tissue, and this is petup. This is all specified. You have a small dorsal tissue, which is in Drosophila, it's called the amniocerosa, and this is extraembryonic tissue. But other than that, the whole thing is embryonic. And then through heavily dependent on maternal patterning, you end up having your segmentation simultaneous or more or less simultaneous across the entire AP axis. So here we can see it in an actual real embryo from image from the Patel lab. Now in other insects, there's this other extreme where it's called short germ development or intermediate germ. These terms are very flexible and they're a little bit gray. It's like we were saying yesterday, morphogen concept. We can't have one hard and fast term because this was defined in, I think, around the premolecular era anyway. I don't want to get the decade wrong. So in long germs or in short germs or intermediate germs, you have, again, a blastoderm like I've just shown you. But the extraembryonic tissue is very extensive. And so this is shown for Tribolium. Here in green is the embryonic domain. And then in the other colors, these are both extraembryonic tissues. So we have the amnion and the serosa. And this is how you get the name amniocerosa from Drosophila, because this is a reduced structure which seems to be fulfilling functions of both the amnion and the serosa. And then from this, you don't just sit developing on the surface. You undergo extensive folding. So you end up with a condensed, so this is a cross-section now through the middle of the egg. You end up with a condensed germ band, which looks much more similar to the vertebrate germ bands. And you have some segments, but they will add more sequentially as it extends. You have the embryo face-to-face with the amnion, so it makes a little bubble. And then the entire thing, the entire egg, is surrounded by the serosa. And the serosa here in blue undergoes no cell divisions through this encapsulation process, so it is just huge cell stretching. And then here is the embryo as it elongates and then spreads around the dorsal side, and the head and the tail will spread around the dorsal side as it undergoes this extension process. So when we look across the phylogenetic tree of the insects shown here, up here is our favorite little thing of Drosophila and some other dipterans. When we look within this grouping, this holometabolous insects, we have these insects that undergo a complete metamorphosis, have a very different larval form from the adult form. We have a range of germ band types. So these are long germs. You can see, so in gray is the germ band when it's condensed. And within the Coleoptera, we have all three forms from short, intermediate, and long. And these three beetles, Buchrytis, we have something similar to Buchrytis. We are studying all three of these beetles in the lab in Cologne now. When you look across the tree as a whole, you see short germ across the entire tree. So we have not found any examples of long germ development across the rest of the insects. And from this, we infer that the ancestral state was short germ or something intermediate, and that this long germ is derived, has evolved specifically. But it has evolved multiple times, at least twice, from the Hymenoptera, the wasps and bees, and the flies, perhaps again in the beetles, but we don't actually know what the base of the beetles were. And the beetles, as I've been pointing out, are focused in here. So now this is what we're mostly going to be talking about, the cellular basis of this folding approach. So when I came into this project, we had one transgenic line available for live imaging. This is a nuclear GFP line shown here. So this is a confocal stack, which I've just projected. This is how I'll be showing most of my data. This is the transgenic line from the lab of Michalis Averoff. And the dots in the cells are just, you don't have to worry about the different colors. No? The dots are different tissues, different fates. Don't have to worry about those. And we will watch this movie now of condensation occurring. So you have a division, and then you have this folding. And the germ band is here beneath. You can't see the posterior of the germ band because it's underneath the yolk, and the yolk is the worst thing in the world for imaging. And the red dots show the serosa. You see they're spread out. And then these different dots are from the germ band itself. So I did, as you imagine, so this was manual tracking back in the day. As you imagine, it took me a little bit of time. But I quickly realized, with the help as well of Tassos yelling at me, that there's only so much information we can get from this nuclear marker, and we wanted to qualitatively describe the cell shape changes underlying this.
Can we see this movie again, please?
Sure. Oops, sorry. Spoilers.
So I'm a bit confused. What happens in that sort of first third?
This third here?
This is the first third of the time.
So this is a division, and because it's a nuclear localization signal,
okay, so it's just
you lose this signal.
A wave that sweeps across, I see.
More or less a wave. Sometimes wave, sometimes not. I'll be showing this again with the membrane markers in two slides. So we wanted to develop new tools, and I really wanted to make transgenics when I got some new tools. But first, to test them, we started just doing mRNA injections for transient expression. This was working really well in pyrality, works in vertebrates, works in the other systems. Doesn't work so well in Drosophila for live imaging. But we thought, Tassos told me to try it, and I went for it. Turns out to work really well. So these are all live embryos. I have injected them with different mRNAs. And this turned out to be really a useful tool because for a nuclear marker, it was very easy to get a histone marker. This is Drosophila H2B. But for a membrane marker, I went through about 3 or 4 different constructs from Drosophila before I found a marker that would actually label the membranes. And like I say, this is GAP43, so this is from zebrafish. Using the same approach, we can do dual labeling. And then this is an actin marker using LifeAct.
Is that real, how wrinkly there's membranes in it?
Yes.
So they're not under great tension?
So this is before the basal cell closure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so this was published with my two supervisors, I guess, with my supervisor and my collaborator back in 2013. So you can check out the paper for more details on the rest of the stuff. By the time I got all this working, 6 months of trying to get a membrane marker, I didn't have time anymore to make transgenics. And to this day, I haven't made transgenics. Several other people have, and it turns out with the enhancers that we have, even when we can get sort of uniform, it is not as strong as you get through mRNA injections. So what we've been running with the students here in this course is just injecting mRNA into the early embryos and getting uniform expression 1 or 2 hours later. So to look at condensation again, this is a slightly different angle. So the ventral midline will be here. This is now a projection from a confocal again. We will see the division. That was that. And then the folding of the tissues until you enclose with your germ band. And again, with your germ band going under the yolk. The posterior is still there. It's just hiding under the yolk. Anterior has these like bunny ears, these head lobes. And the entire thing is surrounded by serosa. One more time.
What's the full difference in cell size during condensation?
The difference in cell size? In what sense?
In the germ band versus.
So the apical area or the volume?
The volume or the area.
So the volume is tricky and the area decreases quite a lot. And this is part of, this is coming up in a few slides, part of what I think is good. Yeah. It's okay. You're preempting what I'm going to share. So this is a,
Can you tell here already how the germ layers are distributed?
Yes. So we have, at this stage, we have the entire DV axis established and the AP axis as well. So we can say here in the ventralmost point, this is where twist is expressed, for example. So we have gastrulation occurring in the ventral region. We have anterior markers like OGD. We have the peril genes coming up sequentially, caudal at the posterior, even some markers of the gut. So this is a very 3D process. So this is now just going to be halfway through the time point, going through individual slices. We'll go through and then come back up. And we start to see some of the problems I had with the imaging of the depth and why I was asking Lars earlier in the week so much about depth penetration of his light sheet microscopes. And so in the end, what I really wanted to get to with this work was the full 3D reconstruction of this. I worked for a while, about a year and a half, with a computational group in Cambridge, or bioinformaticians, who had a pipeline or a program to do 3D reconstruction and segmentation and tracking. In the end, it turned out to not work. So we ended up with a very qualitative description, but you'll see we still were able to get out quite a few things. When we look through a single slice, this is now with the embryo as we mount it, we're like looking on through a cover slip, so it is flattened slightly. You can see how much information you can still obtain with a single slice, but that quickly, so the division will occur now, quickly it folds out of view, and this folding is such a, and then the rest of the movements coming around from the dorsal side, the lateral sides, are out of view when you can only look at a single plane. So we spent a lot of time looking at movies like this, and I carried out a lot of manual tracking in these two embryos and in another embryo as well, just to have an n value of at least 3. For other interpretations or other explanations, we looked at up to 20 embryos, but for this really intense tracking, I did not have the patience to do so many. So here we have a lateral view. This is labeling the boundary between the serosa and the germ band. And here we have a ventral lateral view where we have just across the DV axis, different embryos.
Can I ask, how do you mark the boundary? Is it retrospective?
Yeah, going backwards and forwards. So the boundary between the serosa, we can see through the divisions, and we know a gene which is expressed in this boundary, it's Xen. And if we take it out, then you lose all of the serosa. But the amnion and the embryo, we have no good markers for this. It seems to be a bit fuzzy. So again, we play this, and now you can see the time frame as well. This is imaging at 32 degrees. So from these movies, we came up with a map, a description, a sort of a staging scheme as well of the condensation process, which we hadn't had defined before. This was going to be useful for anyone looking at condensation specifically, but doesn't extend outside of these times. And we can begin to see, like to think about some of the different movements that are occurring here and what might be causing them. So I can show, if we just focus in on stage 3, then make this embryo larger, you can see each of the different events that are occurring. So here at the ventralmost tip point, you have the cells folding for the mesoderm to go in. It's quite disorganized. It's not this beautiful furrow that other insects make. You have involution of the amnion here, so it's folding over the embryo. You have tissue folding here as the lateral parts come up to fold over the germ band. Here we have this very eye-catching, this is, as I said in my email, cable perhaps. So we have this very eye-catching straight border, and when we look at with our actin marker, we do see an actin enrichment there. And Tassos was very excited about this and wanted to write a lot of causation in there, but I was, knowing the literature of actomycin cables from the field of Drosophila research, I was much more hesitant. And this is now the active work study of several other people, including Akanksha, who is here.
So can you just point out where the tissue, respective tissue, is going to be? So where is the mesoderm?
So the mesoderm will be here, right at the edge.
And that's pushing its way in.
Yeah, that's going in. It's becoming multi-layered, different amounts along the AP axis. So
the neuroectoderm?
Neuroectoderm is all of this. I should draw a picture for this. So the neuroectoderm is all of this lateral tissue, and this is the presumptive, or the head primordia, and then all of this and what's tucked under will become...
Those sort of palisaded-like cells, they... extra-embryonic, or down a bit.
Yeah.
Up a bit. Mm-hmm. So just on sort of the lip of the blastopore, or whatever you call it, yes.
Here. Yeah, this is extra-embryonic. Anything which is going to fold over to come face-to-face with this is extra-embryonic. Yeah. This is the amnion. Again, amnion through, not through extensive tracking. So when we look at this process from a same time point, just a different angle, now the tissue, the mesoderm is going in here, you can see they're quite disorganized cells. It's a projection, so you're losing a lot of information, but it's good for an overview. we say these major events of, like, so these midline cells here, approximate midline cells, do not move in the mediolateral.
Yeah. So the yellow points that you're looking at here are not the same as...
So the yellow, yeah, so I should have explained this, sorry. The yellow section is just an earlier stage, but of the same lineage. So the yellow is stage one, the blue is stage two, and then this big purple is stage three.
But they are not the same points in the tubules, right? Like
No. This wasn't done from a spinned rotating thing. Okay. No, we could already have single side. So we see very little movement laterally, mediolaterally of these midline cells, but we see these lateral cells move towards the midline here, and we see, which is getting to your question, the cells, at least the apical surfaces that you see here, are a lot smaller than they were before. And so what is occurring at the stage when we look in orthogonal views, so cross-section now through the embryos. So this is the blastoderm stage just after cellularization. And we begin to see over time these cells elongate and become columnar. And they're a bit disorganized, and when you look at a later stage again, they are very sort of, they're still columnar, but they become pseudostratified. So it's we really need to look at high resolution to be able to image this better. But when you're going, from a cuboidal, okay. So just this section is over in like three slides, so maybe. So to go from a cuboidal to a columnar cell, if you are keeping the same volume, there are consequences. So here, if we look at a schematic of this transition, so this is from modified from a paper from Daniel St. Johnston and Benedict Sancton. We're beginning with cuboidal cells. If you go to a columnar transition, and this is now looking down on the apical part, you will, while if you maintain the same cell volume, you have to decrease your apical area. Similarly, if you go in the other direction to squamous, you will increase your apical area. So in trivolium, we weren't able to accurately measure the volume of these cells because the base of the signal at the base drops away so much. But if the base of the cells, if the cells can have the same volume, this could be an active driving force of condensation.
So what's the percentage change in apical cell size?
This we don't have numbers of. Yeah.
You're saying that those cells are moving in. Do you think it's just because of this sort of constriction in apical cell surface, or are there like T1 transitions and sort of convergence that makes it?
Did you see my talk before?
Yeah.
So if we have this mechanism of, I mean, whether it's a driving force or not, we're not making any claims here. I think it is, but it really needs to be tested. But anyway, if you have a uniform change across the tissue of these cells, and we did look across the axis, and we didn't see any cell shapes, like any stretches along the apical part, then everything should be coming together equally. But we don't see these cells along the AP axis move closer together than when they started. So there must be something else going on here as well. And that's when we started looking into the possibility of cell rearrangements of this tissue. So I focused in on a little window here, carried out a lot of tracking. So this is just where I have drawn the tops of the cells to make them easier to see. And I tracked these cells throughout the period of condensation for about an hour. These cells were tracked after that division because I didn't want the division to muddy things and it makes it harder to understand. But when we look about an hour later, a little more than an hour later, you see these cells have undergone extensive neighbor changes. So this is key intercalation. And this is now brings us to the mind of Drosophila, where we have germ band extension. And this is a process predominantly or largely driven by cell intercalation. And this in Drosophila, the cell intercalation occurring during germ band elongation is the neuroectoderm. So it's the same tissue. It is a little bit, the timing is different because segmentation is occurring at the stage in trivolium and has already occurred in Drosophila. But we have this same process driving it. So then we think, okay, in Drosophila, it's genetically controlled. So maybe in trivolium, we can disrupt this. So we carried out a knockdown of this gene caudal, which in Tribolium patterns the entire posterior half of the embryo. And when you knock down caudal, you lose all of the, or you do not generate the thoracic or abdominal segments. So it's very high up in the hierarchy. And doing the same tracking at the same time points, you do not get any intercalation. But you still get the cell shape changes that I told you about before. So your final embryo is short and fat. So again, these are the same time points. They're matched by the timing of basal cell closure, which seems to correlate pretty well. Next slide.
Now this is a rostralized embryo.
Rostralized.
So it's all anterior.
Yes, yes. So it's a, we have now essentially OTD, OTD for orthodontical, for as the key head marker for most of this, and then a little patch here.
So the original piece that you tracked would be in an OTD negative region of the embryo.
Yes.
So if you look at...
So OTD does not expand here to fill the entire missing domain. We still have... We have tissue, which is, so OTD is still here, and then we have the tissue in the lateral ectoderm, which is OTD negative.
So I guess the question I'm getting at is if the behavior, the lack of intercalation is a feature of the more anterior normal embryo that you're then...
Yeah, so I...
positional change.
I really wanted to look into this, and in the wild type, because in some other systems, of course, the OTX or OTD is not intercalating as much as this trunk region. And I did tracking as much as I could in the head region, and while comparing with my OTD stains, it looked like OTD cells also intercalate, or OTD expressing cells also intercalate. Yeah. But I will come to this in a while, what the... why we lose intercalation in these embryos. Hello?
So does caudal RNA, in the caudal RNA embryo, is cell proliferation is also inhibited, or?
No, so the, so if we look here at this, in this little picture, I know this is a horrible slide, I was gonna skip through it quickly. If we see, look in this picture at the, this is again marking the serosal boundary, we see that the proliferation on the dorsal side, the domain is shifted. So we do not have, so we have serosa all the way down to here now. So there is a shift in the boundary, but proliferation is not affected within this boundary. Every cell still divides once. So like I said, horrible slide. I was planning to skip through it quickly just to say, oh, look, I did lots of work. Isn't that cool? So Tassos and I wrote up a little summary of this, a little commentary on our own paper, which is a little bit strange. It's in this journal which quickly went belly up, has been bought out now. The benefit of this is this article is now open access. And I think Tassos really wanted to do this because the bioarchitecture symbol is like the anarchist symbol. And if any of you know Tassos, this is right up his alley. So we have some summary of the different events that we looked at underlying condensation. There's something I didn't even talk about. So here in the cross-section, you can see this big wedge of yolk. And we proposed, others have proposed already long in the premolecular era, that the yolk has an active role in morphogenesis. And we reiterated this. And we really think this is true. And some people now are hopefully going to be testing this. And then this potential cable, which we see this enrichment of actin. And then, of course, the cell shape changes and the cell intercalation, which we focused on. We didn't, sorry?
Oh, I was just thinking about cell adhesion. Have you looked at that? Because in condensation, sort of in invading tissues, you upregulate various coherence.
Yeah, we have no information about any of this. The first work on the junctions was in the paper with Morain van der Zee. So we tried antibodies and from Drosophila, and they're largely not cross-reactive. But I'm thinking of doing that in a future and upcoming project.
Because you'd want to see sort of asymmetric distribution of various coherence explains some of the cell rearrangement.
Yeah, yeah. And potential attachments between the embryo and the yolk.
Yeah,
the yolk, because the yolk has a membrane around it as well. There are some hints even in Drosophila that the yolk is having an active role in morphogenesis. Some papers on this. Yeah, so the final, we didn't look at apical constriction at all. And this is something which the reason we didn't do this is because we do see apical constriction scattered around the place when the tissue is folding, but we could never say whether it was an active process or a passive process. And so we just chose to not mention this at all and not get into the contentious.
Did you analyze, I know it was difficult, but in fixed tissue, were you able to analyze the basal cell surface?
No, in fixed tissue, I can't find any good membrane marker.
Okay.
And fixing these embryos, at the time, I didn't have a way of fixing injected embryos. Since come up with a way which works more or less. But yeah, I've tried FM dyes, and other people have tried like wheat germ agglutinin and these sorts of dyes, and they're just always too cloudy. Yeah. So this work now was published in 2013, 14, and 15, but in that time I have been doing something else, and these two awesome people have been doing far more advanced quantitative work, and I've got their pictures up because they're both participants on this course. So they're in the lab, I'm just sitting here, they're in the lab of Pavel Tomanchek. They're carrying out spin imaging or light sheet imaging of the tribolium embryos during condensation and coming up with really nice quantitative mechanistic descriptions of these different events during condensation. I guess co-supervised by Tassos as well, I should say. Yeah. Apparently this is Stefan at lunch today. So I don't know where he got this lunch, but he doesn't seem to be getting a lot of work done right now. So, time for the tall stuff. So if there's any questions about the cellular basis of tribolium condensation, that is now moving on to the second phase, which gets a little bit more evolution and hand wavy. Oh, good. Okay, so I told you that there was this intercalation of these lateral neuroectodermal cells in tribolium, and that this is occurring during embryo elongation or during condensation, and it affects embryo elongation. Now, there's a lot more to embryo elongation in tribolium that we can't look at when it's deeper in the when the embryo folds and there's tissues around and it goes deep into the yolk and all these things. It's very difficult to image these stages live, so thus far I've avoided it. This paper came out last year, a very nice paper from Nakamoto et al., where they made, so these are the blastoderm stages, and then these are the fully extended germ bands, and they made clones of fluorescently labeled cells along the axis, and looked at where those clones ended up in the embryo. And there's a few interesting things in this paper about the consequences for this idea of short germ development. The main thing they highlight is that there is no true growth zone. There is just growth across the embryo, and large and then extensive intercalation. So you can see this clone here, and it starts off as a square or circular, ends up long and thin. So from this we can infer that there is extensive cell intercalation throughout the process of germ band elongation. Yeah.
Did they do the clone? It's photocoagulation.
Yeah. So they injected a caged dextrans, and then uncaged it in certain regions. And it seems the reason that they did caged versus rather than just a photoconvertible protein is because these they fixed. And when they fixed photoconverted proteins, it was too weak. So they fixed and then did an antibody against the dextrans. Personally, I think I would have just done live dissections, but I didn't think of this experiment to do at all, so I should probably just stay quiet.
So this implies that your germ layers are distinct, specified, prior to elongation?
Yes, yes. We knew that, yeah, we knew that already. So the DV system, the dorsal ventral axis, almost all the patterning occurs before there is any movement of the cells. There's some things going on in the mesoderm, but otherwise. There's one funny thing, the endoderm. So the endoderm is not really known. I was looking at a couple of markers for endoderm, and it seems the endoderm, based on molecular markers, only comes up at the extended germ band stage. And lichen drosophila comes up at two pools that will then move together, but it only appears at this stage.
Where is it located?
Right at the tips. So or in the head, it's located at the center part of the head, which is going to go down as the stomatium. And then in the posterior, it's right at the tip.
Then it migrates.
Yeah. Presumably, I hadn't looked at it. This is the end of my PhD. Michael was trying to kick me out of his lab. So, yeah, so the keynote from this is that we have this intercalation process. And from our work, our earlier paper, we said, okay, this intercalation is dependent on caudal. Now, caudal, we know, is required for the expression of the pair rule genes and segmentation. So we hypothesized that the intercalation is being driven by the pair rule genes, like in Drosophila. This has been described for a long time. This group confirmed that by specifically knocking down the pair rule genes, and they showed that you do not get this intercalation. You also lose all of, you don't make segments at all, so it's a bit of a circular thing. But now we can, again, bring up a Drosophila and say, okay, so this intercalation occurs across the entire axis, and in Tribolium we have this as well. And this is now what I was already thinking in my quiet thoughts that I didn't tell anyone, making germ band extension in Drosophila homologous to embryo elongation in Tribolium, and I would propose the other insects as well. But we didn't, this is still just like hand wavy. We don't have the molecular link. And we don't know how the pair rule genes, which are transcription factors, cause intercalation in these embryos. That is until the end of 2014, when this very nice paper came out from the lab of Jennifer Zarlin, where they found that a group of toll genes are in fact the intracellular effectors of cell intercalation. So these toll genes has been known for a long time that they are expressed in stripes. These are not the tolls that everyone, the toll gene that everyone thinks of. It's not nothing to do with dorsal ventral patterning, and a minor role in immunity for one of them. So they're expressed in stripes along the embryo. So they are controlled by the pair rule genes, and then with this combination of different stripes, they cause give a code to the cells. So every cell will have a different identity, and it is they propose that it is this code which is then allowing or causing the effect of when you knock down or mutate all three of them, you get a reduction, a massive reduction in intercalation. So these toll genes, because they are not transcription factors, so they are transmembrane proteins, they take the positional information from the pair rule genes and turn it into intracellular changes in myosin. And the paper goes into a lot of molecular detail to come up with an explanation. The explanation doesn't fit with all of the findings, and they are open about this. It's a working model. I think Tom Alacqui has some stuff to say about that as well. So we wanted to see, okay, this is driving is driving the intercalation in Drosophila. So is it also functioning in Tribolium? And my boss, Siegfried Roth, was very kind and allowed me to run wild with this for a year rather than studying dorsal ventral patterning. So now we need to take a comparative approach, and we look at the toll tree as a whole. So in Drosophila, this is the tree of the toll genes. We have these up here. They may be branching together, maybe separately. These genes are weird. I don't want to think about them. This is the dorsal ventral toll. Toll 9 is also a bit weird. We don't know a lot about it, but it seems it's more similar in structure to the vertebrate tolls. And then we have this nice little group down here, which is clearly the best group of tolls. This is these three tolls are what were studied for the cell intercalation process. And toll 7 is also expressed in stripes in Drosophila, but it seems not to have a function. So as I've already shown on the tree, we can now, like looking at other insects, we can begin to see how these tolls came about. And I've drawn this as a duplication. This is because in other lineages, you only have toll 7, you do not have toll 2. So this is a dipteran or a Drosophila-specific duplication. I haven't looked into the details of where it comes out. You then also have toll 6 and 8, and all the other insects we looked at, so 7 or 8 other insects from the phylogenetic point of view I looked at, also have toll 10. So across the insects, we seem to have this general state of 6, 7, 8, and 10. These numbers are really annoying, and I'd like to just be able to call them straight through. A, B, C, D, but this is what's established, so I stuck to the literature. So I looked at the expression of these genes in Tribolium, and toll 1 has already been well studied in Tribolium and has a clear role as required for DV axis patterning. These two genes are not segmentally expressed in Tribolium. Now remember, the Drosophila intercalation tolls are segmentally expressed. This is what I was looking for. They have a neural expression or they're not expressed, and we have transcriptome data to back that up. But when we look at toll 7 and 10, you begin to see the stripes already from the blastoderm stage coming up. So you have a head domain, and then these stripes, and these stripes coming up. This looks exactly like the parallel genes. So even skipped or odd skipped or runt will come up like this in a big domain, and then refine, and then you get sequential addition of stripes. You also have secondary stripes coming up in the in every segment. So at the beginning, you have a stripe in every other segment or every other parasegment. And then you have, as a segment matures, you get a stripe coming up in the segment that didn't have the expression. So by the end, we have expression in every segment. And this is a neural function, which has been described for these genes and is now being studied a lot more as well in Drosophila. This paper was published about 2 months ago, so you can also check that out for more details. So this is TOL7. TOL10 is shown here. It looks very similar, but there are some differences. So when we look at them, the two of them together, you can see that they are, well, you can't see, but I'll tell you, they are semi-overlapping when they come up, and then there's a gap before there's another, the stripe of the next one.
Are there some oscillation?
Yeah, so we know, in Trivolium we know that there are, we are pretty confident that there are waves of the parallel genes, and they oscillate, and we think it's a three-gene system of Eve, Odd, and Runt. When you knock down any one of them, you lose the entire segmentation cascade. So at this posterior region, you see an expression domain appear, and then it moves anteriorly. This is...
gradient starting from the anterior or something?
So there is caudal. So caudal is expressed at the posterior, but we don't know that it's a gradient. There's a paper saying it is, but they only did an RNA. They only looked at RNA, and they did a color. So they looked at, they didn't do fluorescence either, so they didn't account for tissue structure. Well, now we have a nice antibody for caudal, and that antibody was made available to this group, so I don't know why in the paper they didn't use it. It's a little bit funny. But yeah, so for the parallel genes, which we know are high up in the cascade, they are definitely moving down the embryo. This was really nice work from, including Andres Sarrazin, who was here for the first few weeks, where they were culturing the embryos, cutting them down the middle while they were still alive, growing one for a little bit longer than the other, doing some very preliminary cell tracking, but just to show that cell movements couldn't account for this movements of domains. I looked at these in parallel with the parallel genes, and they are expressed so similarly and in the same register that these must also be moving up the embryo. So the next question is, are they functional? This is always what we're, what my boss now is driving. Whenever we find a new gene, he wants to know what's the function. So we carried out double knockdowns. And this was work done with Nadine Frey in the lab. I should have written this down the bottom. Nadine Frey in the lab. So this is a wild-type embryo, fully extended germ band that I've taken out of the egg and flat-mounted. In red is shown the segment polarity gene wingless, just to mark the segments. And in the double knockdown, the embryo looks like this. So when you take out TOL7 and 10, the embryo is much shorter and wider than it should be, but it still has all of its segments. In single knockdowns, we didn't look at embryos. We looked at first, in our first round, we did singles and doubles and looked at larvae, and single knockdowns had no effect on hatching rates, and the larvae were fine. I'm beginning to wonder if there is some subtle effect in the embryo, but this just gives me food for projects for the future, I guess.
Did the red domain meet in the midline? I can't see.
Sorry?
Did the red bits, do they meet in the
midline? No, there's always a gap along the midline.
Yeah.
In the knockdown, there's always gaps as well, but you begin to see some patchiness, and you see some asymmetry as well. Sometimes you lose a segment or part of a segment on one side. But again, we're just using wingless as a marker. So I looked at about 10 or 20 embryos, I should say 20 embryos with this marker, and there were a whole range of defects, including some that appeared to be in the midline. I think it's because, so these genes are expressed in the mesoderm as well. But you always had the right number of, the correct number of segments. So to see, yeah?
Does number of the cell between the segment is also reduced?
I didn't look at cell number. No, I didn't look at this. This would be really cool. So cell number and overall shape of cell clones. So I did live imaging again, just as before. So this is with the GAP43 YFE, the membrane marker. This is the wild type, and then this is the double knockdown. I did this, I was visiting the lab of Pavel Tomanchek, thanks to Akanksha, she was my little buddy on the microscope sitting with me, so I didn't break things. We can watch condensation in these embryos, and it is broadly similar. The knockdown is wider and has a little bit of trouble getting in. Some of the tissues are a little bit fold over and a little bit of a, they don't look totally happy about it. Just play this again, if it plays, or my computer crashes. Play it again. So it folds. They're not exactly the same orientation. I chose these two embryos because it shows as it elongates, this is the same time window, and the wild type is long and goes around to the dorsal side, while the phenotype, the double knockdown, so I'll just stop this here, the double knockdown is much shorter than the wild type. And we quantified this in the paper, so the numbers are there.
Yeah. So if you look at the video, so the mutant, he, like, on the, I guess that's the, like, this is the anterior end, right? The left-hand side is the anterior end.
Yeah.
He doesn't really touches the boundary while, like, he doesn't really, the embryo doesn't really slide along the, while the wild type does. Is there a reason for it?
You mean moving around?
Yeah, like I mean, side? Generally, like, the embryo would, like, use the boundary and slide along, and then in the mutant it doesn't. Is it just because it's too short, or is it, why does it bend and not touch the boundary?
I would think it's something to do with it being too short, but there would also be, could also be some problems in the total, I mean, the total overall structure is affected. So maybe there is some mechanistic effect there, explanation that could be there. That is, so you're talking about a gap here?
Yeah.
No, we should chat about that afterwards, though. This isn't something I even thought about or noticed. So we went to the same analysis as before, integration. I was very satisfied to find in the wild type, it looked like I had done 3 years earlier, and in the double knockdown, like in the caudal phenotype, we again completely lose intercalation. So this is the same tissue as I was imaging, as I was doing before in the first part, and the same time frames that I was doing in the first part as well. Yes.
So
the whole thing is shorter along the APX.
Yeah, but are the cells changing, are the apical cell surfaces different in your...
There's no change in the condensation stages. Yeah. They still become columnar. It's like in the caudal again. Yeah, but the embryo is still, the germ band still elongates to some extent, and this is through division. So the next obvious thing is to look at division. And this was one of my hopes of what we would be doing this week, but the group had other ideas. So now we can, like in Drosophila, we can say, so in Drosophila you have the maternal patterning system and setting up the peril genes. Peril genes drive expression of the toll genes, and these affect intercalation. And we have the same system here where we have caudal is required for the peril genes. Peril genes drive the toll genes. We did a knockdown to confirm this. Although it was a bit of a dirty experiment because you lose all segmentation when you knock down the peril genes. But then these toll genes are driving this intercalation. And while this is only a qualitative description, we didn't have a lot of embryos, or we didn't, I didn't do the tracking for a lot of embryos, we could say that this is a lot, has a lot stronger effect than in Drosophila. So in Drosophila, you do see some intercalations, but here we see no intercalations. Maybe this is a time frame thing, so I want to be soft about that. We can also watch this live, thanks to a very nice reviewer that suggested I make this live. So I spent a day and a half drawing the outlines of cells. Now you can see the same thing that you saw before in the fixed. So now we do the Evo-Devo thing, and this little bit is going to be very quick because we have only a little functional data. where we climb the tree of the arthropods, and we look to see what is going to be, how widely conserved this is. Initially, we thought maybe it was a speciality of Drosophila, because Drosophila has to develop really quickly, so maybe they came up with this really cool system for driving extinction quickly, found it in Tribolium, so where else can we find it? So these guys are about 250, 300 million years diverged. You find varying accounts of this. This tree is also is just a summary. It's outdated already. But we wanted to extend a little bit, so we looked within the next major lineage is the Hymenoptera. So these are bees and wasps. Then the Hemiptera, these are bugs. Like leafhoppers and things like this. And in the Orthoptera, so we looked in the crooked gryllus that we already heard about from Cassandra. So this is now 350 million years diverged, and 400 million years is a really huge timescales. They're still staying within the insects. So these are the creatures themselves. We had to work in a wasp. I would have preferred working in a bee, but this is a horrible little parasitic wasp. And Hymenoptera are also long germ, like Drosophila. This is the bug, Oncopeltis, and here is the cricket, Gryllus, which is my least favorite insect in the world. So the tree across the insects for the tolls is a little bit different. Sometimes you have duplications of toll 1. So in Tribolium, you have 4 toll 1 and paralogs. Same in Nasonia, you have 4 toll 1s, but these are independently duplicated. This could be due to their roles in immunity. One or a few toll 9s, don't know what they're doing. And I was looking at these. And in each of the insects we looked at, this is the grouping of these tolls. And these tolls always come out far away from the other tolls, no matter how, like which part of the sequence, or even used small parts of the protein sequence to do the phylogeny, and they still branch out very strongly. So I started looking into protein structure and actually found these tolls are substantially longer than the other tolls within each species. And it's the extracellular leucine-rich repeats. They have expanded a lot, so they have many more. So this qualitative difference, as well as their function, we coined the term for this clade, or we're calling them the long tolls. So we'll see how this gets picked up. The reviewers made no comment on it, so we've got that far. We're not suggesting changing the names of these within insects. That would just introduce new terms. So now looking across these insects, again in Drosophila and Tribolium down here now, looking in Nasonia, we have striped expression of toll 7 and of toll 10. In Oncopeltis, so Oncopeltis is intermediate germ, so it does this germ band thing, sequential segmentation. We have striped expression of 3 of the tolls now. And similarly in Gryllus, we have striped expression of the same 3 tolls as in Oncopeltis. So we don't have functional data for this. We are now going to be doing some work in Nasonia, but knockdowns in Gryllus and Oncopeltis are not super effective, and triple knockdown would itself be a real challenge, I think. I was hoping Taro would tell me otherwise, but maybe we'll just have to wait to make some mutants. Because if things go, as in Drosophila and Tribolium, we can make mutants of each independently, and it will have no effect on viability. So this could be a nice system to be able to maintain our mutants without balances. If you want to look at more in situs or get really in detail about how these are coming up, in the paper there's more in situs than you can shake a stick at. But the overall story is they're stripy. So now moving past the insects, we can look now. I skipped out Gryllus on this tree, maybe because I don't like it subconsciously. We look outside of the insects. And this is looks like a small leap, but it's a big leap. So this is from 525, 560 million years diverged. And these are approximations, of course. And also, each of these lineages, so the chelicerates and myriapods came to land separately. The crustacean lineages, it's a real mess from the phylogeny of the pancrustacea lineages. But these are in the water, and they have their own real specializations.
Sorry, can you go back to the other one? I saw something you might have interesting. So the other one. So the stripes, do they extend to the legs? Or this is just...
Yeah, so there are separate expression domains in the legs. Okay. Yeah. And this is conserved outside of the insects as well. And this is then another prong to my future research. making a nice foundation study on the legs, which have never been studied before, and you'll hear awesome work about that next Friday.
Awesome.
From Timor. So yeah, we're looking now really far distances. And in one of these, we do have some functional data, but I'm not going to tell you which one. So this was work done in collaboration again. In the crustacean Pariali, which is we have here in the lab kicking around, it's done with Tassos Pavlopoulos and his wife Valia. I did the Strugemia work, but this is material provided by my old supervisor, Michael Akam. I spent my entire PhD in this lab, and I managed to never do an in situ in Strugemia. And then during my postdoc, I had to email him and ask for some material to look at a segmentation gene. It was a little bit, fun. And then the spider work was done by Matthias Peschmann, a really, really talented postdoc who I've had great pleasure working with. So first up in Pariali, now we need to look at the tree a bit differently. And so this is the insect tree again, and this is going to be the same for the next few insects, or the next few species. These red lines are the Pariali tolls. This we were able to get out from transcriptome data and genome data, which is unpublished. Should be coming out soon. Genome is huge, but apparently it's nicely assembled, according to Tassos at least. So we have a relatively simple toll tree. So we have one toll 1, one toll 9. These guys floating around in the middle, I couldn't resolve these. And two within this clade. Tassos and Valia did in situs for all of these at the embryonic stages. And we find a stripy expression. This looks like a single stripe, but I'll show you in a second why I say it's stripes of expression. So here we have a domain within, this is the segmenting region of the embryo, and then here is some of the neurogenic expression. The in situ looks terrible because they have such large nuclei that the cells just have a very small amount of cytoplasm. And here is some a more anterior expression, which we also see in the insects. So now when you look at embryos of different stages, so this is the young, middle, and old, because of this really nice grid of nuclei, we can actually say which segments are going to become which from a very early stage. At least Carsten Wolf, who was here last week, he was able to figure this out. So we can say at this stage we have a single stripe, and it's in parasegment 5. In this stage we have a single stripe, but it's in parasegment 7, and in this it's in parasegment 9. So what we have is we do have stripes, but they are so dynamic that they turn off before the next one turns on. And in the insects, we always see a continual expression because they turn on in the maturing segments before they turn off. Now moving on to the centipede, things are both more and less complicated. So the centipede phylogeny, the centipede genome came out a while ago, and it's a little bit complicated when it comes to the toll genes. So another paper had come out describing the toll family, and they were from bioinformaticians, and they weren't able to resolve most of these branches. But they came out with this single branch coming out here. I repeated it using the same analysis I was doing for the other species, and similar thing. This is a horrible mess. But here we consistently get a single toll. So I thought, why not look at it? And it's stripy. When I got this in situ, the stain came through, I suddenly realized why so many people in Michael's lab were studying segmentation in Strugemia, because it just the embryos look stunning when you get these stains coming up. Finally, moving on to the spider, and this is the last part now. We have a nice genome for the spider, which is still unpublished, and some transcriptome data, and we have about 26 tolls. We found a few more after I drew this picture. We don't have any tolls within this group, but we do have this group of 5 tolls here. So Matthias, while looking at all of the tolls for roles in DV patterning, he looked at these 5 tolls as well and found 2 that are expressed in the embryo. So one, so this is the spider embryo. It develops a bit differently to the other things. But basically here we again have sequential segmentation from the posterior region. And one is expressed in stripes, and the other expressed in the broad domain. When you look at an earlier stage, the stripes are further to the anterior. So the stripes seem to be coming up at the same time as the pyrrole genes. And in the spider, we can look at what's going on here. RNAi works pretty well in the spider. It still can be a little bit weak with double knockdowns, so we were hoping for the best. Again, we carried out single knockdowns, and there was no effect. And in the double knockdown, which is shown here, the embryo was substantially wider than normal. So this is a midline marker here, just showing the expansion of the tissue. And when we look at the segmentation, so this is engrailed as the segment polarity gene, we find that the segmentation itself is not severely disrupted. Now, the thing that I normally don't, that would gloss over at this point, we state very clearly in the paper, is they are not any shorter than they should be. And we think, well, our interpretation of this is that, so in spider, we know embryonic development to be highly regulative, much more like vertebrate systems. So you can do things in spiders like make a little cut in the early embryo and it will generate two completely new germ bands that are just attached to the head and spread out. And this happens spontaneously as well. And it shouldn't, I mean, the embryos don't hatch, but we think this is involved. So we know the anterior-posterior axis is heavily dependent on notch and so and wingless, and maybe these pathways are conferring this regulative development. So they say they have more cells than this guy should have, but we did no strong quantitation of that, quantification. So now we can go back to this early tree and start to put some stuff on it. So in Drosophila, as I've already said, so in Drosophila and Tribolium, we can now draw this picture of, with the overall goal of looking at how the embryo elongates, this is one part of the puzzle. This says nothing about the other thing going on, which is cell division and other possibilities like mechanical tension, or hindgut invagination, how this could be involved in dragging it along. But this is at least one part of it. In the spiders, we have a few more question marks. But from a recent paper from Alistair McGregor's lab, we know that caudal is required for expression of peril genes. And then because of the similarity of expression, it's remarkably similar, I would say the peril genes are driving the toll genes, but we are keeping this soft. And again, we do not know for sure that these toll genes are affecting cell intercalation. Could have something to do with sorting after division. But by the end of this year, Matthias promises me that he's going to do some live imaging of this in the double knockdowns. So with that, I will end, and you guys can get back to thinking about the more hardcore mechanistic stuff. I have to thank, of course, my boss, Siegfried Roth, and then all of the people who are doing the work in different species on this project, and some of my other collaborators, of course, and thanks for your attention. This was all like these were looking at each component of how the cells are structured,
yeah.
And looking at it at a mechanistic way or quantitative way was my goals when I was starting this project in my PhD. It's a cop out, but it took so long to establish these techniques that I wasn't able to. But now I'm really thinking about this for another postdoc. I took a side trip on my first postdoc. The questions I want to answer, get to, is this the 3D nature of the condensation. And the technology just wasn't there then. It seems still it's very difficult to do this sort of stuff.
So if the head has all the constriction just posterior.
Yeah.
But do you have any idea from your new dates and how that looked like the occurring?
Not really, and I don't know whether it's a real constriction or just the difference in tissues. Yeah, because the head lobes are a larger tissue, and we don't know how they're folding, really. So there's a lab is spending their entire time working on the head, and it could be a simple matter of there is intercalation in the head domains, as we were talking about before, but not very much. It's just really hard just to track those cells for an extended period of time during these stages because of the folding happening over them.
And just remind me, when does the stomatium?
The stomatium is sometime around halfway through germ band elongation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you have some markers like forkid comes up around the same time. For the stomatium?
Yeah.
No, I don't know. No. We know Wnt is heavily involved in the AP axis.
Yeah.
So this is a really nice. It's actually. You know, if you knock down some of the components, then you lose most of your AP axis information. Thanks.